for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. On this Monday night, a tight labor market and concerns about equity more broadly are seeing more and more companies across North America dropping degree requirements, university degree requirements for new hires and promotions. But despite lip service to the breaking of the so-called paper ceiling, is it actually working? And if not, why not? We find out. With the U.S. presidential election now just a little more than 6 months away, we look into why policy experts of this country say Canada needs a plan for our always crucial relationship with the U.S., regardless of who wins in November and what that could entail. Lucy Walsh knows a whole lot about fame, growing up with a famous dad, Joe Walsh of the Eagles. Her uncle by marriage is Beatle Ringo Starr. She too is an actress, singer, and songwriter. And now you can add author to that list. She's with me to talk about her first book called Remember Me as Human. It's a story of family. It's a story about her grandmother, fame, secrets, and a whole lot more. But first, we look into what's driving a sudden surge in student anti-Israel protests on university campuses in the U.S. and now here in this country, including at McGill in Montreal, and whether this will come to an end as the school year wraps up soon, or whether it could turn into a heated summer on university campuses right across the continent. I woke up this morning in Ottawa at about 4 a.m. Eastern, and then flew back, took advantage of the time zones, and flew back out west where I am back tonight. But of course, Ottawa this weekend, I was out on Saturday. It was my mom's birthday. That's why I was there. And I witnessed one of a pro-Palestinian protest, quite a big one, actually, marching its way through downtown Ottawa. And that's really been a big story over the weekend. And let's begin tonight in Montreal, not far from Ottawa. Stop the bombing now, 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 now. We are the students. We won't be silent. Stop the bombing now. That is the sound of pro-Palestinian activists, and they say they have no intention of dismantling their camp at Montreal's McGill University, despite the institution threatening to take action against them. Critics have argued the protests are anti-Semitic and leave Jewish students feeling unsafe, but the McGill encampment spokesperson says the protests are peaceful and aimed only at Israel's actions in Gaza. Immigration Minister Mark Miller was asked about this today. He says protests should be broadly protected on university campuses across the country, but they cannot be tolerated if they become violent, hateful, or intimidating. Miller's Montreal riding is, of course, home to McGill University. And again, the size of this demonstration has tripled in the last 24 hours. Again, university officials say they have seen evidence of anti-Semitic language and intimidating behavior.
Some of the acts alleged, if they are true, are extremely concerning. But I think as politicians, looking at that setting, looking at what McGill represents, what academia represents, what that space represents for people in the context of the war in Gaza, is something I think we have to be very judicious how we treat that.
Immigration Minister Mark Miller there. The protests at McGill appear to be inspiring similar movements right across Canada. And of course, they follow a wave of protests on American university campuses, with students demanding their schools cut all ties with companies that do business with Israel.
The protests continue and the encampment stays at Columbia University. The pro-Palestinian student demonstrators defying a university-imposed 2 p.m. Monday deadline for them to clear out or face academic suspension. This protester.
We will not move until Columbia meets our demands or they are moved by force.
Talks with the university broke down over the weekend. University President Manu Shafiq saying the protesters' key demand of divestment from Israel is a non-starter. Dave Packer, ABC News, New York.
Well, joining me now from New York with more on this is Robert Cohen. He's a professor of social studies and history at New York University, and he studied student activism over many years as well. Robert, thank you for your time tonight.
Okay, nice to be here.
Just to put this into context, because, of course, we're more than 200 days into the war in Gaza, what set this latest wave of protests, specifically in New York, where this seems to have begun and is now spreading to other campuses, both in the U.S. and across the border here in Canada?
Well, there's been of course, the war itself, but the reaction, the firing of the president at Harvard and then the Columbia president testifying in Congress, acting like she'd be tougher than the Harvard president was, so she didn't get fired. And then when she came back the next day, they evicted basically a nonviolent encampment that was not disrupting the university on Columbia University. And that mass arrest then I think, helped to publicize the protest against the Gaza war and spread to other campuses. And so it, here at NYU, they started an encampment. And within, like, by that same night, it had been evicted under the sort of rationale that it was breaking university regulations and that it was anti-Semitic. But the faculty here, have found no evidence for either of those claims. And what's really striking about this in the history of student activism in the United States is that usually, if a protest is going to be evicted and with arrest, there's going to be some kind of major violation of university law regulations or the law, like taking over a building or blockading a police car or something. Just sitting on the lawn outside of the academic buildings, or in the case of NYU, in front of the business school, that is in the plaza, and not disrupting classes, that's something that you don't usually see evicted like this. And I think it's a kind of a reaction to the threats from donors who see these protests as anti-Semitic, and Congress, which the other day had the Speaker of the House of Representatives appeal with a bunch of Democrats on the Columbia campus, even after the president had arrested the students initially, calling for her resignation because apparently they didn't think that was tough enough. And I should say that NYU, just one last thing, the arrest came right after the protesters had been going through a Passover Seder with the Jewish students there. So, the charge of anti-Semitism here seems, I'm not saying there haven't been issues in other places, but it really did not, nobody was really convinced by that here.
Right, because it struck me as the timing of it, and I was following when the president of Colombia was at Congress last week or a few weeks back, that this has become a bit about free speech and protest as well as about what's happening in the Middle East.
Right, yeah, and also I should say the thing about that these people on the right and others want these protests suppressed. Anybody who knows the history of student activism, if you want to build a student movement, bring the police onto campus and arrest people, because whether or not they agree with what the protesters are saying about Israel and Palestine and Gaza, they don't want their friends and classmates and students, if they're faculty, being arrested without having broken a law. So in other words, what I'm saying is that the civil liberties issue becomes folded into this in a way, and so it always backfires. So at both at Columbia and here, after the initial arrest, the students came back, and at least the case was here. They're right in back of my apartment building in front of the Paulson Center here at NYU, and they were allowed to stay as long as they didn't have tents up, which is a little bit hard when it rains, but they agreed to it. So they've been out there for 5 days with nothing illegal, no anti-Semitism, just no incidents at all. And I think that kind of attests to the fact that there was a kind of overreaction on the part of these administrators who I don't think are responding so much to the facts on the ground of these protests all the time, but the threats to their jobs if they don't come up as being tough on these protests.
Just the demands themselves, because, of course, there's been a divestment movement in place for many, many years on many campuses these days over the past few decades. I remember it from my time back at Concordia in Montreal, 20 some odd years ago. But what specifically are the demands then of these protesters? I mean, what would it take for them to pack up and go?
Well, some of them are wanting the universities to divest their holdings and companies that are involved with the military in Israel. In NYU, and also I think at Columbia as well, we have like a branch campus in Israel in Tel Aviv, and they want that to be closed down. And those kind of demands, I think, are very unlikely to succeed. I think they're almost a holdover from what the Students for Justice in Palestine have been asking for years. So even though in that sense, I don't think the movement's going to succeed, it does succeed, I think, in raising people's awareness about the war issue. And in the United States, that plus the by the way, I should also mention the 30 states in the United States have laws against state agencies and states doing business with companies that divest from Israel. Mm-hmm. So it's not like with South Africa where nobody's defending apartheid. So the divestment movement in the 80s worked. But here there's a lot of pushback because Israel has a lot of support. So that demand, those demands I don't think are going to go anywhere. But I think the larger issue of raising people's awareness about the war, and this is an expression of concern about all the killing of civilians, that is having an effect. And, combined with what happened in Michigan, where this is more the adult population, mobilized uncommitted votes against President Biden, I think that has had an impact on him changing his tone to what he's been saying to Netanyahu. So I would just say it's a mixed bag. In other words, I don't think these demands for divestment are going to be successful, but they've already helped to, I think, add to the pressure for President Biden to not give Netanyahu a kind of blank check with whatever he wants to do with the Gaza war in terms of civilians getting killed.
What's your sense of who's out there? Are they all students? Are there others? I mean, anytime there were sort of pro-Palestinian protests, when I was at university, obviously it brought in a grab bag of people, not necessarily just students at the school itself.
Oh, it's mostly students. And here it's exclusively students, because to get into the encampment, not just the police, mm-hmm. but the students themselves, the monitors make you show an ID card. So out here, it's only students. And it's a combination, by the way, of longtime activists who've been involved in this issue, some of whom are, you know, from their Palestinians or Muslim students who've been very concerned about this issue. Others are new to the whole movement who are really just upset about the war and wanted to express their hopefully, you know, their hope to put the pressure on the United States to end its support of Israel's war making here. So I think in terms of NYU, it's, and I think other places, it really isn't essentially, it's a student movement. There might be outsiders who are, if schools allow them to come in to the protest, they can come in, but mostly it's a student movement.
And it feels like we're at a delicate time here, because students at other campuses, and we see it happening in Canada, are reacting to what's happening at each one of these campuses, specifically to begin with, at Columbia.
Right. Yeah, I think there is a kind of and also you have to remember this is an era of social media. So mm-hmm. people find out, like in the 60s, it usually took, you know, which was the biggest era of student protest, it usually took a little while for this kind of avalanche of protest to occur. Whereas today, because of social media, it happens much more quickly. But so does the backlash against it. You know, so like Congress right now is considering a bill to really redefine what anti-Semitism is and make it really very, it's very complicated sorting out anti-Semitism from anti-Zionism. And this law is really, you know, has a kind of equating the two in a way that even, you know, Jerry Nadler, the congressman here from Lower Manhattan, who is mm-hmm. is strong supporter of Israel, has reservations about.
The White House Monday didn't weigh in directly on how it believes universities are handling protests taking place on campuses across the nation. Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre would not say if the president has spoken to the leaders of any of the universities where demonstrations are taking place, or say what the White House thinks administrators should do.
Americans have the right to peacefully protest, and we're going to continue to call out any type of hateful rhetoric, any type of potential hateful violence here. It has no place in America. Anti-Semitism, we're going to call out.
Karen Travers, ABC News, The White House.
Robert Cohen is with us from New York City. He's a professor at New York University who studied student activism over the years. Robert, I've been listening to politicians in Canada, and you've heard them off the top of the show, and now, of course, the White House saying the same thing. I'm trying to figure out where this line is between the right to a peaceful protest and the concerns about anti-Semitism, and where exactly, how are you going to define that? And if so, how do you crack down or not on these protests? It seems like quite the gray zone at this point.
Well, I think the point is there's a difference between public speech and harassment, right? So, and that's not very well understood. And so if somebody, loves Israel and they hear somebody talking about from the river to the sea about, really changing the nature of the Israeli state or basically having a Palestinian state in its place, that is how that's heard can be seen as anti-Semitism. But, there's different ways of interpreting that. And I don't think, in terms of the First Amendment in the United States, that's protected speech. But if you threaten people or if you direct slurs at them, that, it's harassment and you can file disciplinary charges. So I think the thing is, there's also confusion here, like about what do you do if there's some bad actors? Do you, if you have a huge crowd with 1,000 people and a few people are guilty of misconduct, you don't evict 1,000 people. You go for the person who's doing the illicit act. And I think there's a confusion about that. And also the tendency to kind of, blame everybody for what's happening. And also, I know this too, that because of the cultural conservatism, at least in the United States, there's almost always a tendency to, student movements have historically been very unpopular because they challenge, conventions, they raise difficult questions. That's what the university is about. And so whether it was the sit-in movement, the freedom rides, the free speech movement, the anti-war movement of the Vietnam era, or this movement, they're always unpopular. And the whole point of the First Amendment is to protect speech that might be unpopular. It's all speech, but particularly political speech that's raising critical questions. So the idea that you're going to suppress an entire movement because of some of these ugly anti-Semitic incidents is really problematic. And as I said, and sometimes it just becomes a catch-all. Like, as I said, here at NYU, that argument was used. And, I was there, and you look at their literature, it's actually recruiting anti-Zionist Jews. So the idea, are we say that, and I have Jewish students who are involved in the protest. So it's really problematic to pick the whole movement as being guilty of something that maybe just a few people are. And that's problematic. It's also a kind of, you know, intolerance. And I think it's when I see people being evicted and arrested for nonviolent protests, that to me kind of reeks of authoritarianism. And with these presidents of colleges fearful for their jobs, who's going to protect free speech and academic freedom on campuses? So I think that, you know, you can do both. That is, you can, sort of oppose anti-Semitism and support free speech. But the way the conversation is going around here, it's like people are forgetting about free speech. And the irony is that some of these same conservative politicians who railed against left-wing wokeness on campus about disrupting hateful conservative speakers, now with a movement that you could say is leaning left, they want that. They're as like, they're as politically censoring as the woke people on the left they're always railing against. So right. What concerns me is from the left and the right, like, who is left to defend free speech and academic freedom with all these people calling for oppression? That's really problematic.
What's your sense for the rest of, term is almost over. Is this going to continue on into the summer, do you think?
Well, it's always hard for student movements to continue over the summer, but remember this, the Democratic and Republican Party convention, presidential convention is over the summer. So I would not be surprised if this war continues, if students are mobilizing for those events. You know, as I'm sure you know, in Chicago 68, there were huge disruptions and really basically a police riot attacking the protesters, which really helped to, you know, basically discredit Humphrey and send Richard Nixon to the White House. So, you know, I think there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party about that may be happening again, and that's empowering Trump. So it's really, you know, I guess in answer to your question, obviously campus protest is going to be tamped down, but those same activists might then direct some of their protests off campus, particularly these two very attractive targets, the Democratic and Republican parties.
Well, Robert, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Joe Walsh has to be one of the most famous musicians of the 70s, no, and the 80s. I mean, the Eagles, hard to kind of overstate how huge the Eagles have been. So what's it like to grow up in the shadow of a famous father, especially a famous father who's had some addiction issues? That's one of the many things that Lucy Walsh, his daughter, tackles in her first book called Remember Me as Human. She, again, is the 41-year-old daughter of famed Eagles guitarist Joe Walsh. She, too, by the way, is a singer and songwriter, an actress in her own right. She's appeared in a bunch of shows like NCIS, Criminal Minds, as well as on stage. Here she is with Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm, by the way.
Hello.
Hi.
Cheers. May I join you?
Yes.
Tell us all about this.
Salman Rushdie?
Yes, that's Salman. We're the Fatwa Boys.
Hello, ladies. I'm the manager. I really apologize about your lunch being late. There was a disturbance in the kitchen.
Ah, what kind of disturbance?
He's not going to tell.
I am about to tell her. I've ticked all the boxes.
You didn't tick one box.
Disturbance.
You didn't tick a box. The boxes are empty. I beg to differ.
Thank you. Thank you.
To the Fatwa Boys.
To the Fatwa Boys.
That's Lucy Walsh in Curb Your Enthusiasm. She's the one who asks if Larry's sitting with Salman Rushdie. Her first book, though, very much deals with the sometimes difficult story of growing up with a father who was often absent from her life early on as he struggled with addiction. He's been clean since 1993, of course. And it's dedicated, though, to her grandmother, Wanda, who filled a real void in her early years, and letters that her grandmother shared with her from her late husband, Lucy's grandfather, who was off fighting in the Second World War at the time. She also spent 3 days interviewing her grandmother before she passed away a few years back. And it was Wanda who utters the words that would become the title, Remember Me as Human. By the way, her father is now married to Marjorie Bach, who's the sister of Barbara Bach, so who's been married to Ringo Starr for many, 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 many years. So Lucy has an even more unique perspective on family and fame. And she sort of puts it all together in this book, which is sort of touching, has a great message about making sure you talk to the people you love before they go, and also just growing up in this family, kind of in the shadow of a lot of fame. And Lucy Walsh joins me now. Congratulations. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Ben. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Yeah, what an exciting time to tour a book. I mean, I know you've sort of been around show business your entire life. You've been in show business most of your life. But writing and then touring a book, I imagine, is a pretty different experience all around.
It's so different. I feel so smart.
Good. It's a smart book.
I'm usually touring with my music or acting in a project, and now I am an author. I just feel very smart these days.
Good. It's interesting. I mean, obviously, a lot of people know your name, know your father, know you from your career as well. But what's it like to grow up in? I mean, I think people are always curious to know what it's like to grow up with someone in a band like the Eagles, only because I imagine it's both a blessing and a bit of a curse. And that's what you always hear.
You know, I used to answer that question a lot differently than I do now. I used to talk about the glitz and the glamour of it and tell people the inside stuff that I thought they wanted to hear. But this book now called Remember Me as Human, it's caused me to talk about it in a much different way, and I think a more important way that we can all learn from. Growing up in a very famous family with not only my dad being in the Eagles, but my uncle being in the Beatles, I have seen the inside of fame, and I can truly tell you that it is all smoke and mirrors, and no human is any different from any other. We are all the same on a soul level, and that's really the message of my book and all the work I'm doing right now on this topic of what makes us truly human. And I believe that I was born into that situation for that very purpose, to learn deeply what it means to be human and to see that fame does not make you any different than anyone else.
Just for listeners to know, Lucy's dad, Joe Walsh, is married to Barbara Bach's sister, and Barbara Bach, of course, is Ringo Starr's longtime wife, right? Did I get the family tree correct?
You got it.
There you go. It's a you, and also what I found interesting too in reading the book and then looking back at sort of watching other interviews that you've done in the past is how your relationship with your father and your relationship with his fame and fame period has evolved over the years.
It has. I think when I was younger and he was constantly having to go away for work, I equated that to fame being the reason that he had to leave all the time. And I chased fame myself as a kid because I decided, as we do as children, how to survive and get the love that we want. And that has really transformed for me. I've been able to let that go and understand that I am worthy just as I am. Fame does not make me any more lovable or worthy than I am in this very moment. And that goes for all of us. And I, in that spirit, I created the Lucy Walsh Studio, in which I life coach and use voice and music therapy with clients all over the world to really unravel these limited beliefs that we have kept in place since we were children. We walk around our entire lives believing these things that aren't helpful to us. And my work with my clients is to really let go of all the dirt that's in our way so that we can get to our true radiance as humans. So I coach people all over the world. LucyWalsh.com is where you can connect with me about that.
It was interesting too, because of course, within the book, I mean, there's a lot of family truths in the book. And one of them, of course, for those who will be reading it to sort of find out more about you and your father and so on, there are some brutal truths in it too about what it was like to grow up around him. I don't want to take away from the fact that there are some magical moments that you've described elsewhere as well about sort of realizing the joy that your dad's music brings too, which is important to remember.
Absolutely. It was not an easy life growing up with a famous father. It was not. I mean, you know, there's maybe that'll be my next book, but no. I truly have been able to see my father as human, and I that is why this book is such an important read for all of us, because I talk a lot about it in the book, not only my father, but all of my parents and my grandparents, and for us to all arrive at this within our families, because we've had our parents on pedestals for so much of our lives, and we don't allow people grace. We don't have mercy with our loved ones. We hold them to these very high standards. And I've really been able to love my father for who he is and support him, and I have nothing but gratitude and admiration for him. But yeah, you know, our family's definitely been through the ringer with what it means for a member to be famous, because everybody's on that train. It's not just him, it's the entire family. And I have to say, when he won the Kennedy Center honor and he was awarded by Obama, that was our entire family's achievement. I really felt that that was my achievement as well, because we all sacrificed to make one person go.
Right.
And my family does the same thing for me. So I've learned a lot from watching my father go through the process of being a public figure before me.
Yeah, I really want to get to the book, because there's some really interesting things about your grandmother, Wanda, and love letters from the Second World War and so on. But one thing that I've heard you talk about as well is just being a witness to how others react to fame is interesting as well. And you sort of explained that, you know, you knew Eagles fame and then you saw Beatles fame, which is something even a little bit more strange, I think, at times. But it must be odd to sort of not only have grown up around it and been in it, but also to watch how others react to it, which is an oh-so-human condition.
That's so right, Ben. Yeah, I've learned a lot about humanity from watching people react to fame. People assign it magical qualities and they get very weird around it and they do very strange things. And we are all so available to each other, I think, now with social media and technology. And people have access to each other in a way that hasn't existed before. So we always have to be careful. You got to watch your back.
Yeah. And you saw just around the Beatles thing too, is even more sort of aggressive and intrusive.
Yes, it really has been. I take privacy and the privacy of my family and my own privacy very, very seriously. It's not something to mess around with. But I will say, just for everybody on this topic of, again, being human, which is what my book's all about, to assign magical quality to famous people is depressing on the outside, and it's very isolating to the people on the inside that it's happening to. And I think for us to release that and really just embrace each other on a soul level as humans is where our greatest joy lies.
And I think sometimes, and what we can finish off is that one of the things that's fascinating too is when you look at something like an addiction issue, which you lived through with your father, that we don't understand why someone who seems to have so much would find themselves fighting those kinds of demons.
Well, it's very isolating to be a famous person, because you feel isolated from your fellow humans. Mm-hmm. You feel like an outsider. As much as you would think that a famous person feels like they're in a club, I know now, because I'm a public figure myself, that it's completely isolating and actually lends more to a life of addiction, because you're trying to find connection and comfort somewhere and you just feel completely alone sometimes.
Lucy Walsh is an actress, musician, and now author. She is the daughter of Joe Walsh of the Eagles, niece now, or a niece, I should say, by marriage of Ringo Starr of the Beatles. We've been talking a bit about fame, but let's talk about the book, because there's a lot to digest in this book, Remember Me as Human. What an incredible origin story. And I was interested to see that the letters have been given to you by your grandmother that she'd received from her husband during the Second World War a long time ago. And it took you a while to sort of figure out what to do with them. But what a beautiful tribute to someone who meant so much to you within your family.
It's been incredible. My grandmother Wanda gave me the 63 remaining love letters that my grandfather Dale had written to her over the 3 years that he was away fighting in World War II. He was gone from 1943 to 1945. They did not hear each other's voice for 3 years. There was no FaceTime. It was not like it is today. And she gave those 63 letters to me when I was 17.
Did she ever explain why she gave them to you at that age? She must have been almost the same age when she received them, right?
I was blown away when she gave them to me. I asked her why me, and she just said, "I just feel that they need to go to you." Nice. And I don't know why, but I'm so grateful, because they've really shaped the course of my life.
Also, because, I mean, there are love letters out there. It seems like such a different time. But the idea that someone in war could sit down and write something out and put it in an envelope and send it off. But what did they tell you? And she talked about them, too. You sat down with your grandmother to sort of talk to her about life in general before she passed.
I did. So I have a question for everybody. I want you to think of a loved one who has passed that you miss very much. And I want you to hold them in your heart for a moment. If you could go back and ask them one more question, what would it be?
Wow.
And that is what Remember Me as Human is about. It is about the three final days that I spent with my grandmother Wanda when she was 97 in her nursing home, interviewing her about the letters and her life. And it is that that is the reason it's a must read for all of us, because we all wish we could ask one more question of somebody that we miss so much. And I got to do that, but it was no accident. I made that happen because I knew that I would regret it if I didn't. And that is my message to everybody listening. I think we take each other for granted, and I think we take time for granted. And if I can inspire my readers to change that, I've won. I've achieved what I set out to do.
Because Dale, your grandfather, developed Alzheimer's, right? And you were reminded that time can be fast, and that the stories you'd like to hear and the questions you'd like to ask don't get asked sometimes.
That was the catalyst that made me go interview Wanda, because I had lost Dale before I got a chance to ask him anything about the letters that he had written. And it was devastating. I know that we've all been touched by Alzheimer's in some way. It's very common. And I think that my trauma response to losing him that way was to start asking questions of all my loved ones, because if I could just collect everybody's memories and keep them safe forever, then Alzheimer's couldn't win.
You know, I always watch those videos on social media that interview people in their 100, you know, people who are over 100, and say, yes, what is the one thing you shouldn't worry about when you're, what's the one thing you worried about when you were young that you shouldn't worry about? And I'm always fascinated by the answers. And part of that was kind of what Wanda shared with you as well, which was some good old fashioned wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, they all say the same thing, don't they? They just say, I wouldn't have enjoyed the ride more. I wouldn't have worried so much. Nothing matters. Just enjoy it. They all say the same thing. Wanda said, life is one big party in the end.
And Remember Me as Human, where did that come from? Because that's her, those are her words, right?
Yes, and that was her dying wish. It actually came from her. She told me, I want you to tell the truth about everything, because I do touch on some pretty dark stuff in this book. Mm-hmm. My family, just like all of our families, protects these deep, dark secrets for generations. Things that involve addiction and molestation and suicide and depression and alcoholism. And the book is really about breaking that generational trauma. And she gave me the permission to tell the truth about the things that she had said in our interview. And she said, I said, but it makes you look bad. And she said, no, it makes me look human. And I want to be remembered as human. And so the dedication is to all my readers. May we be human while we are alive, and may we be remembered as human after we are gone. And that's why this story belongs to all of us, and why I felt compelled to share it with the world.
Lucy, congratulations. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's so nice to talk to you.
Loose puck off the draw. Nurse not able to clear. Kempe right point shot blocked, and the rebound cleared. And Edmonton will win game four. Stuart Skinner with his first career Stanley Cup playoff shutout. Final score, the Edmonton Oilers 1, the LA Kings nothing.
Back in behind the zone, that is Cale Makar. Makar just about lost the puck at center ice, but he makes a great move. Crossed over the line. High slot. Makar shooting. Scores. Oh, wow. What a goal by Cale Makar. Coast to coast.
Yeah. Well, it was the tale of two cities, to quote Dickens, waking up this morning. The best of times and the worst of times, without being too melodramatic about all of this. But both the Oilers and the Jets are heading home for their respective Game 5s, one tomorrow, one Wednesday, in their best-of-seven opening round playoff series. In very different situations, Edmonton are one win away from clinching their series against the Kings after a 1-0 win in L.A. last night. Stuart Skinner, as you heard there, getting his first ever career playoff shutout. And the Oilers were outshot 33-13, so it was a real playoff-feeling game. Tight. Meanwhile, in Denver, the Avalanche, I mean, I watched quite a bit of that game yesterday, and the Avalanche scored those three unanswered goals in the second to put the Jets on the brink of elimination with a 5-1 win. With more on this, Cam Moon, the regular season play-by-play voice of the Oilers on 630 CHED, an Oilers Plus analyst, and Jim Toth is co-host of the Jets at Noon and the host of the Jim Toth Show on 680 CJOB. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, Cam, thanks very much, Ben. I should start by either Cam owes me $20 or I owe him $20 from the Western Hockey League days, but I can't remember which.
I'll let you. I'm sure we can
figure that out at an establishment.
Cam, I guess we'll start. I mean, what a game! I had to get up really early this morning to come back out west. But what a game! What a win!
Yeah,
what a win! That's the kind of game that it seems to me that's the game the Oilers have lost several years in a row now.
Yeah, fair enough. That with all the scoring that had happened in the series leading up to Game 4, that isn't what was expected. But Edmonton gets a 1-0 win, and Stuart Skinner, as you heard, first career Stanley Cup playoff shutout with 33 saves. I thought Edmonton did a pretty good job keeping opportunities to the outside. I don't know that Stuart Skinner had to make a lot of, you know, 5-alarm saves, but Edmonton only garnered 13 shots, although they did. If you looked at scoring opportunities, like good quality scoring opportunities, I think Edmonton was slightly ahead. But it came down to, and what has come down to a fair bit in this series, is Edmonton, their ability to score in the power play. They go 1-for-1, and they're 8-for-15 in the series. And Los Angeles's inability to score in the power play, as they had one power play, they didn't score, and Edmonton has successfully killed off 11 out of 11 shorthanded situations. So, yeah, it wasn't exactly what was expected, but it may be exactly what the Edmonton Oilers needed, was a real tight victory like that.
Yeah. Jim, you know, I was watching, because it was on earlier in the day, I was watching the game last night, and I didn't think the Jets looked particularly bad. It just looks like the Avalanche are on such a roll right now.
Yeah, they've definitely found another gear, and you've got to give the Colorado Avalanche a lot of credit. I did favor the Jets going into this series, but I thought it would go 6, and I thought this would be a more hotly contested. It's interesting what Cam was saying about the power plays in that series between LA and Edmonton, because that's just been the difference between Winnipeg and Colorado. A lot of people are wondering about the goals per game and if Connor Hellebuck's on the same pace as his Vezina Award nominee again, came out today, and he is. Mm-hmm. I've looked at the goals and I've studied the how many, you know, slot shots the Colorado Avalanche are getting. I think are 47 to 23 or 24 for the Jets. They're using their speed, and they came in with a different game plan from the regular season, where their forecheck is different, and they're getting in on the Jets' D. And the Jets have had so much success this year exiting their zone and using their forecheck. And it's just been really difficult for the Jets to move the puck out of their own end. And I think Connor Hellebuck's battling the Colorado Avalanche, and then he's battling the turnovers that the Jets have had that have led to that many shots from the slot and the high-danger chances. So Winnipeg's been in every game, and they can't score. And when they take penalties, this Avalanche power play is on another level. It was 5th overall in the National Hockey League in the regular season, but they just go. And I just don't mean on the power plays, Ben. I mean, like, they'll get a 2-minute advantage, the Jets will kill it off, and that team is rolling and finds another gear for another 3 or 4 minutes after the power play ends. And then they draw another one, and it's just been the death of the Jets so far, that once the Colorado Avalanche get a couple power plays, it was 40% going into yesterday's game, and they got 2 more power play goals. It's just rolling, and has really been a problem for the Jets.
Yeah. What's the mood like in Winnipeg? Because, of course, I mean, this is a good team. They had a good year. Hellebuck looked great. And, you know, they were going in I would have given it as a toss up going in against a really tough Colorado team. But is there a sense of frustration? I know you'll all be out again tomorrow night. You know, you'll white out the place. It'll look great, sound great. But what's the mood like?
It's not good, Ben.
Sorry. God, the rhetorical question.
Scene from Mad Men when he gets in the elevator and he says, how's your day? Not good, Bob. Well, it's not good, Ben. This is a team that, through the players' own admission on our show throughout this year and unasked, would volunteer that Josh Morrissey, Kyle Connor, Adam Lowry, you know, we were aware that as the wins were piling up and it looked like they were going to make the postseason, say, this is about making the postseason. We're well aware that as a group, we've underachieved the past couple of years. And they have. They went to the Western Conference Final in 2018, and they just can't get out of the first round. The one time they did in the bubble year, they swept Edmonton in front of no fans and then got swept by Montreal.
Yeah.
This is a team that is too good to have not gone a round or two further than it's gone in the last 5 years. And that's why I kind of thought this was their year. I knew Colorado was good, but they'd played Colorado and beat them 3 times this year. I knew it wouldn't be easy, but that strife and that sort of you got to lose before you win, I thought was going to come to the fore right here. And the one thing I will say about the Jets is they have not played their best hockey. They were on an 8-game winning streak going into the playoffs, and they won the first game, so 9 games. But they have not played like they did in Dallas with a 3-0 shutout, and the next game in Colorado 7-0 within the last 2 weeks of the regular season. So there's a lot of it's over and same old Jets and not again, and I shouldn't have bought in going on in this city. And I think the players and Captain Adam Lowry addressed that a bit today, that he said, you know, every team's different, every year is different, and how you play and how you peak at the right time is different. But he understands that'll be the narrative if they don't get a win tomorrow night and extend this series, that once again, same old Jets, great regular season and not much in the postseason.
Yeah, Cam, it reminded me sort of watching, you know, hockey back in the 80s. And I always loved, I mean, I love the Oilers. I love that Jets team with Dale Hawerchuk and Paul MacLean and so on. But man, they could never get past Edmonton back then. But Edmonton now, I mean, what's the mood like there? But you don't want to jinx anything, right? But man, they've looked good against the Kings. I thought this was going to be a really tough one for them again. LA's sort of had their number for a while. I thought this was going to be a tough one this year. And it has been, but they're finding ways to win.
Yeah, they are finding ways to win and in different ways. And I think for the most part, the Oilers have played really well so far in this series. They still have to win on Wednesday to get by. And I would expect the Kings' best game on Wednesday. So I'm not counting any chickens or putting any carts ahead of any horses at this point. But the mood, as you would expect, is, you know, incredibly good around town.
Right.
There's expectation. They lost last year in the second round to the Vegas Golden Knights in a series that was sitting at 2-2, and things were looking fairly decent until they weren't. And 2 years ago, went to the conference final. So they've had some playoff success here recently, but you could tell from the entire group last year how bitterly disappointed they were and how eager they were to get back to this point. But around town, like the Friday night here for game three in Edmonton, the Rogers Place was full, the plaza next door was full, and the fan park with the great big Oktoberfest like tent was full. So it was absolute craziness downtown, which is wonderful, and it was a lot of fun. But yeah, I would say the expectation level, I would think for most fans, even just going into the playoffs, that they would win this round. And it remains to be seen in how many games and what that looks like. But the Oilers have put themselves in a very good spot. Stuart Skinner is, you can see the step in development for Stuart from last year, his first time through the Stanley Cup playoffs, to this year. That's a big part of it. Of course, when you've got Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl doing Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl things, that doesn't hurt either. And a bit of depth in the lineup with the likes of, you know, Corey Perry and what he has brought to the mix, and Adam Henrique coming over from Anaheim. Yeah, and guys like Evander Kane, who had the Gordie Howe hat trick a couple of games ago. It was only the third time in Oilers history that that's happened. So that was kind of a big deal, too.
Yeah, you have to tell me about this WHL bet then, Cam and Jim. What is this all about? What did this guy? This sounds like it might go back a wee while.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if it's a bet. I was just making reference that we probably borrowed enough money over each other over the years, or at a certain establishment over the years, that we probably owe one of us owes the other one $20. But I've known Cam when he was calling Red Deer Rebel games, and right. When I arrived on the scene in Kootenay and was doing games in Cranbrook, he was one of the first guys I met, and they had some really good rivalries, the Red Deer Rebels and the Kootenay Ice at the time. And I was on the scene, and Cam was one of the first guys I met, and was always very gracious, very generous with his time, and just got to know him over the years. One of the good guys in the game.
Awesome. I have the Victoria
unless
Royals.
He owes me that $20.
That's worth 20 right there.
There you go. We'll have you back on before this is all said and done, and we can settle this again. I live right around the corner from where the Royals play. The WHL has been one of the best parts about moving out west, by the way. I have to say it's been a blast to watch the WHL.
A wonderful league. A wonderful league.
You well, know, it's I'll a be, great league yeah. and a great place for broadcasters to cut their teeth just as much as young hockey players.
So. Absolutely. Well, I'll be fingers crossed for the Jets tomorrow night. I guess Edmonton, we have to wait till Wednesday. Thank you both. I appreciate your time tonight.
Awesome. Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having us. It was a great pleasure to be on with you. Enjoy the playoffs.
Let's get to this London Drugs thing. Now, I was in Ottawa over the weekend. So normally I end up at London Drugs, which there's one right near where I live. We go there all the time. So I didn't realize they were closed until I read about it this morning. But the retail pharmacy chain, of course, they have 80 stores across Western Canada, as far east as Manitoba, as far west as out here on Vancouver Island, shut all their stores on Sunday. They were still closed today, mostly. Victim of a cybersecurity incident, they're saying. Have a listen.
The company didn't say much else in its announcement yesterday on social media, only that it will provide updates as soon as it can. And it said pharmacists will be able to help their local customers with any urgent pharmacy needs. But various news outlets have reported that London Drugs shared by email that the issue was a cybersecurity incident and that the store closures were done out of an abundance of caution. London Drugs has more than 80 stores across Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and British Columbia. Karen Rebo, the Canadian Press.
Yeah, you can see that statement from the company on social media. They said on it, at this time, we have no reason to believe that customer employee data has been impacted. And they're still saying that pharmacists will support customers with urgent pharmacy needs. I think there was a few other things that they were able to do today, like charge a transit card and so on. But other than that, they're pretty much shut down. And that's a big deal. You think this is a really major retailer in Western Canada, and they're shut because of this. Jamie Harry is Director of Cybersecurity and DNS at the Canadian Internet Registration Authority joins me now. Jamie, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I was just trying to think. I mean, we've often talked about, you know, cyber attacks and so on business. I can't remember one having to shut down all their stores like this for a few days at this point.
Yeah, it is certainly, I wouldn't call it unprecedented, but unusual. One of the more interesting and perhaps more impactful ones on the central or eastern side of Canada was the Toronto Public Library a little while ago, which saw all of their locations shuttered for quite a few weeks. In fact, getting all of the books back in circulation took months. So these things can certainly happen. They cross over from digital to the physical world.
Yeah, take me a bit. I mean, I don't think we know exactly what's happened here. I've heard you interview. You've been doing a lot of interviews, I know, but you sort of had some speculation, to put it mildly, but just you have an idea of what could be going on here that would precipitate something this major for a company like London Drugs.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I think we'll get more information as the days go on, but there's a number of things we can safely assume. They're taking abundance of caution, as was mentioned in the introduction, and I think that's partly for legal and internal risk mitigation, but also on the behalf of customers. If you, for example, as a security leader within any organization that's experiencing this, if you're unsure if the threat actor has been entirely neutralized, out of an abundance of caution, as was mentioned, it's best not to open the doors again. With that being said, I think there's pressure, I'm sure, from the board to get revenue flowing again. So it's this sort of give and take, a bit of a tug of war. With that being said, there may also be other pressures from regulators, certainly investigators, everyone who's in the fray right now, trying to document everything and make sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed.
Yeah, what's your best guess as to, because for the sort of the non-knowledgeable about cyber attacks, I think a lot of us sort of have a concept of what it might be, but what physically would be going on then that they would have to sort of shut everything down and not let any more customers in?
Well, part of it is the determining of the threat actor. So although we don't usually go as far as what we call attribution, trying to name an individual attacker or attack group, trying to understand, was this intentional? Was this a targeted attack, or was this sort of incidental or accidental? One of the changes in the cybersecurity landscape over the last 10 years was that because of automation and tools like AI, threat actors are able to cast a wider net and sort of attack more targets with less effort. So what that means is, as a defender, as someone who's experiencing this, you need to know how they got in, what they're trying to accomplish. And if they've reached out to you, certainly with a message of ransom or something like that, it might be very clear. But if they haven't, then you're sort of left to your own devices to figure out what they're trying to get at. Once the investigators have figured out which areas of the systems they've had access to, that gives a better sort of indication of how they should respond. So if they did have access to customer, especially health data, then they might respond in a different way by contacting those individuals more discreetly, certainly working with authorities, certainly working with privacy commissioners and other regulatory bodies to make sure everyone's regulatory needs are met. But if that's not the case, if there's no customer data, then I'm sure they're working as quickly as possible to just get those systems back up and running so they can begin servicing customers.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect clearly they'd like to open as fast as they can. I mean, yet another lesson. I think part of it too, not that it's any of this is necessarily shocking when you read about it happening to any number of companies, but it's always a reminder that companies like this, need to be safeguarding their systems, right?
Yeah, and I certainly don't want to single out London Drugs or any particular organization to say that they're not doing enough, because I think that's a fairly blanket statement that could apply to any organization. But I think, to your point, it is certainly incumbent on especially providers of sensitive products and services such as healthcare to, I would say, go an extra mile. And one of the problems that I've seen recently is that, as much as the technology is advancing, the laws and regulations are not quite keeping pace, not to say that they're not trying, but what we really need in Canada is some regulation with teeth that forces, or that first of all gives regulators some capability to investigate and materially fine or regulate with some sort of authority. But also we need guidance to these organizations that do have this sensitive information or that operate critical infrastructure, because they're left to try to fend with best, quote unquote, best practices, referring to consultants and then industry, vendors and things like that. But if the government certainly, which I believe it's working on, will release some concrete guidance, I think that'll give everyone a lot more confidence in terms of how to act.
Well, Jamie, thank you. I guess we'll find out more when we find out more, but for the time being, I wouldn't want to be behind the scenes either on the technical side or technological side or on the public relations side at London Drugs right now. So there you have it.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. If I could give one piece of advice, obviously, it's have a plan in advance. One of the other things, if you think about it like a fire drill, right. You don't want to be, drawing the map of where to go and teaching people how to, react in the moment. So having that plan and exercising in advance is certainly something that all organizations could learn.
Yeah, I was told once that if you're dusting off your crisis response plan in the middle of a crisis, it's not working. That's part of the problem,
Yeah, exactly.
Jamie, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's take you inside classrooms in Ontario. You may have heard yesterday, Ontario's education minister laid out some pretty tough new policies to limit cell phone use in classrooms and restrict access to all social media sites or several when you're using school networks. Not when you're using your own plan, but when you're using school networks. Stephen Lecce also announced a ban on vaping on school properties. All of it meant to curb distraction levels in the province's classrooms. It's a health thing too, both mental health and physical health. He says the new policy is based on the feedback he's been getting.
Every parent and teacher we speak to has shared the growing problem of cell phone distractions in class during instructional time, in addition to the disturbing rise of vaping in schools amongst our youth.
So what does this mean in practice? Starting in September, kids in kindergarten to grade 6 will now be required to keep phones on silent and out of sight for the entire school day unless they get special permission not to do so. The older kids, grade 7 and up, will see cell phone use banned during class time. And it also, and this is interesting, it will require all publicly funded school boards to block access to all social media platforms on school networks and devices. And Ontario says it's the first that time that's been done among Canadian provinces. Sachin Maharaj is an assistant professor of educational leadership, policy, and program evaluation at the University of Ottawa. He spent a lot of time looking into these policies. He joins me now. Sachin, thanks for your time.
Good to be here.
I guess just your initial reaction, I think a lot of people in Ontario specifically had seen this coming, but what did you make of the actual details of it?
I think it's an attempt by the province to get
school boards and schools to take this issue more seriously than in the past. The initial ban was rolled out in 2019, but part of the problem was it was kind of vague as to when phones could be used and when they shouldn't be used. And teachers didn't really feel supported by school administrators and parents when they were trying to implement these restrictions. And so as a result, the ban largely became symbolic. So what this is attempting to do is provide more clarity as to when phones can be used and when they can, and signal to school boards and schools to take this more seriously. It's part of the reason that the announcement was coupled with a plan for increased mandatory training around these issues, as well as having teachers report on students' distraction levels on report cards. And so what this is attempting to do is to signal to schools that this is actually a priority, this is important, and hopefully this will lead to a shift in terms of what actually happens. Because the reality is, an announcement by the province doesn't in and of itself change what's going to actually happen in the thousands of schools and classrooms, right? This all depends on how it's actually implemented. And in schools, teachers are now responsible for so many different things that that they're being told to focus on. And so you can't focus on everything, obviously. And so this is something the province is trying to get schools and teachers to reorient around this as a priority.
Yeah. I suppose give them the tools to be able to know. I guess what you're saying is that a lot of the problem here has been sort of the grayness of it all, right? Like, when do you confiscate a phone? I mean, we've seen bad reactions to it. Obviously, there's been some incidents that have been high profile on social media, but you could just see that in theory, this would be an easy move, but in practice, this wouldn't be so simple.
Particularly if students and parents aren't supportive. The reality is, no teacher wants to get into a hostile interaction with students around this stuff. And students, you know, when it comes to actually giving up their phones, they're understandably reluctant because phones have become, you know, repositories of our personal lives, right? And so a lot of students feel that personal attachment to their phones, not to mention that, you know, during the pandemic, we kind of forced kids to be on their phones and their devices, both for learning and for social communication. And so there's a natural reluctance to give that up. But given the negative impacts that phones are having on student learning, as well as their social and emotional development, I think, you know, we do have a moral responsibility to try to address this, but it has to be done collectively with students and parents and teachers all on the same page.
Does it go without saying at this point that they are having a pronounced negative effect on learning?
Yeah. So I think it's definitive at this point that phones are having a negative impact on student learning. I mean, this has been demonstrated not just experimentally in a number of research studies, but if you look at the math, reading, and science scores in Canada, they've been steadily decreasing over the past decade, and not just in Canada, but in many other developed countries around the world. And when the OECD looked into what the causes of this are, the use of mobile devices, particularly phones, for non-educational purposes is cited as a large factor. And when you look at the research at what kids actually use their phones for during the school day, perhaps not surprisingly, the number one thing is social media, followed by YouTube and gaming. And then you can go even further. You can look at the number of notifications kids are getting during the day, and it's in the hundreds. And so these kids are constantly having their attention pulled away from what's going on in the classroom, and they're constantly being distracted by their phones. And I should say, it's not just kids. I mean, this is something we all...
I was going to say, yeah, you just described a lot of us. You know, I was out for dinner the other night, and, you know, yeah, you see it everywhere. But within the classroom, I think back to my high school days, which are a long time ago now, but even the distractions of sort of passing notes around could be, and this is just this that on steroids, right?
Completely, yeah. I mean, the narrative that has been around for the past decade or so is that we need to teach kids about responsible use. Mm-hmm. And the reason that this has failed is because these devices, and in particularly the social media apps, aren't designed to be used responsibly. They're designed to grab your attention, and they're really effective at that, right? And, you know, you had that anecdote you just shared. A couple of weeks ago, I was at an education research conference at a course with a number of other professors. And this is a course we all willingly signed up and paid money for. And halfway into it, you know, I look around and everybody's on their phones. And one hour into the course, the guy beside me, also a fellow professor, was playing video games. So it's no different than what you would find in a classroom. But if adults are struggling with this, it's even more of a challenge for kids who are still developing.
I found it interesting the way they've divvied it up as well, of course. I mean, it's different in different provinces, but in this case, for Ontario, it's going to be kindergarten to grade six. Phones are out of sight for the whole school day, right? Unless there's something specific going on. Whereas for older students, they're going to be able to access them between classes, I gather.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense to differentiate because, you know, older kids have, I think, more legitimate reasons for why they might need access to their phones, right? They might have after school responsibilities, they might be working, right? They might have cars that they're taking somewhere, something like that. And so parents understandably want to have some level of communication with them. And it makes sense to kids have at least access to it, not during class time. Whereas for younger grades, it makes more sense to just have it kind of out of sight for the entire school day. And so I think hopefully when you see that tiered approach, that is something that parents can hopefully support as kind of a reasonable middle ground.
Yeah. And when they sort of talk about back to basics, right? I mean, I think that's a bit folksy, to be honest. It's political, right? But when you think about it, I get the notion, right? A classroom is for learning. So therefore, much like in the old days, you weren't allowed to sort of read your own book in class, right? You sort of had to follow along. That this is kind of trying to harken back to that. I always worry, though, that it feels like it's tough to put that genie back in the bottle, as you just mentioned.
It is, and it can't be something that teachers are just left to enforce on their own, because then we're just back to where we were since 2019, right? Teachers can't be expected to enforce this against resistant students and unsupportive parents. And so I think part of what will make this effective is if school boards reach out to parents and students in genuine consultation in terms of crafting these policies and getting a shared understanding for why this is important. Because I think if you ask parents, you know, do you want to create a learning environment where your kids are going to learn as much as possible, where they're going to be kind of socially and emotionally as healthy as possible, they would say yes, obviously, right? And it's having those conversations about how restricting these phones during the school day will help build that environment.
Sachin Maharaj is an assistant professor of educational leadership policy and program evaluation at the University of Ottawa. He's done a lot of research into the use of cell phones and social media and so on within the classroom. Sachin, I was interested by this idea of school boards blocking access to social media platforms on their school networks and devices. That's something that you've looked at in the past. I know there was that lawsuit not long ago filed by some of the big Ontario school boards against a bunch of social media platforms. This sounds like, once again, the government's hoping that at a board-wide level, they're going to start to crack down on not just how students use their phones, but also what they can access within. I mean, I suppose they could access it on their own plans, but at least within the school system itself, you can't access social media, certain social media on your phone.
Yeah. So again, going back to the study I mentioned that tracked kids' phone use during the day, the number one thing kids are using their phones for is accessing social media. And so I would say that's probably the number one distractor. And it's not just even when they're accessing it themselves. If you look at the number of notifications kids are getting from these social media apps throughout the course of the day, it's in the hundreds. And we know that each time a student's attention is interrupted, it can take a long time to refocus on what you're learning, up to 20 minutes in some cases, right? And so this kind of puncturing of students' attention during the day is a big part of what's disrupting their learning. And so limiting access on the school's networks to these apps is a way to try to address some of those issues. Now, of course, students can always access them through their own data plans and things like that. But again, it's just sending a signal that schools are trying to support creating as healthy a learning environment as possible. And I mean, it's not just that. You mentioned the school board's lawsuit. Mm-hmm. It's not just the impact on student learning that I think educators are concerned about, but also on kids' emotional and social development and well-being. So UNESCO just issued a report looking at the impact on girls' mental health in particular of social media apps, because that's when we look at the mental health data and the increasing concerns around social media and kids' mental health, it's disproportionately affecting girls. And we think that's because girls use social media sort of more and in different ways than boys typically do. And so I think, you know, schools are rightly concerned about this as well, because they're having to provide more supports to address kind of kids' mental health and well-being. And if we believe social media is a contributor to that, that's part of the reason for trying to limit access, at least during the school day.
Which makes sense that yesterday's announcement also was paired with a cut down on vaping. So it really is sort of taking on that prism of health, right? Of the health of teenagers, both physical and mental.
That's right. And I mean, the problem is coming out of the pandemic, when we really sort of forced kids to, you know, be on screens and these devices, and we went back to in-person learning, a lot of the just general norms in schools were sort of difficult to reestablish, you know, with things like phones, but also vaping and just kind of other issues. And so I think this is a part of kind of a try to comprehensively address, yeah, kids' health and restoring, you know, some level of behavior in schools that supports learning.
When you look at, to go back to the cell phone issue, I mean, I suppose that jurisdictions right around the world are struggling with this, right, in some way, shape, or form. Not all. I mean, some have much stricter policies from the get-go, if I think of some, you know, certain countries. But it feels like a lot of countries like Canada, the U.S., are struggling with exactly the same issues around phones and distractions and social media and so on within their learning environment. Schools, as you mentioned earlier, teachers are now responsible for an awful lot of things going on in their classroom because the phones have allowed the world into the classroom in a way that it never was before.
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue that is global, really. You know, I mentioned the decline in math, reading, and science, and one of the things I noted is that, yeah, it's not just in Canada. It's Canada, the U.S., and many other developed countries all around the world. And different school systems are trying to respond to this in different ways. But we do have, you know, some research that shows that when schools do ban phones, they do see things like decreases in bullying, increases in academic performance, which is encouraging that if we can actually implement some of these changes, that it will help improve the learning and social environment for kids here.
Sachin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Canada and the U.S. do best when we do it together, when we're well integrated, when we recognize the prosperity that's created on both sides of the border. That's going to continue to be our approach. Obviously, Mr. Trump represents a certain amount of unpredictability, but we will make sure we're pulling together and preparing for whatever eventualities.
The Prime Minister obviously speaking a while back now. I think he was asked about that in the fall. Of course, we now know at that point whether Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee was still up in the air. That's, of course, now official. And the election is just 6 months away, of course. It's almost May the 4th. May the 5th would be 6 months until the U.S. presidential election on November the 5th. So it's getting close. We've, of course, been talking about it. We talk about it every Friday on the show. If you want to listen to last Friday's, I know that Sid Smith was in for me on Friday. Thanks to Sid for doing such a great job. And he picked up the ball on that one. We talk about what's happening in the U.S. every week on Fridays, just to keep abreast of it, because it's such a very, very important election in so many ways. I mean, sometimes we get a little, I think sometimes on Canadian radio, we talk a little bit too much about what's happening in the U.S., but this one feels like a really consequential election, as they all are, but this one feels particularly consequential for Canadians, right? And just the impact it's going to have on us and our, you know, I mean, I didn't realize this until recently. For a while there, we started to diversify our economy a little bit. But now it's back up. I think 78% of our exports go to the U.S. A quarter of our GDP depends on the U.S. And so our relationship with the United States is as important now as it's ever been. But are we as relevant to the U.S. as we once were? Are we as indispensable a partner to the U.S. as we once were? The world has changed, right? It has. You know, there was a time, if you think back to the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, the time we just celebrated the life of Brian Mulroney, of course, and his relationship with both Presidents Reagan and Presidents Bush and free trade and all the things. And just, it felt like at that time, Canada's relationship with the US was based a lot on trade. There was some stuff around energy and so on. Fast forward to 2024 and all that's happened in the 20th century, and just 21st century rather, and it just feels different. It feels like there's been some real bumps in the road, whether it was Stephen Harper's relationship with Barack Obama, which wasn't great. Certainly Donald Trump's relationship with Justin Trudeau, which wasn't great. Now it's been a bit warmer, obviously. But, you know, the Americans have lots on their plate. There's lots going on around the world right now. We're living in a different kind of world. And one wonders whether Canada is seen the same way in the halls of power at the White House, Capitol Hill, and so on. And it feels like we're not. And part of that is just the arc of history, right? Things have changed, and America's in a more hostile world right now. But also, there are things that we've done too. I mean, there isn't much we can do about American politics necessarily. We deal, as the Prime Minister was trying to put us, you know, a sort of rosy picture on. We deal with whomever's elected, right? Whomever Americans elect. But there are things we could be doing as well. And it feels like over the past while, maybe we haven't been doing enough. And this isn't just one party or one politician. It's just sort of been the back and forth with the way we interact with the U.S. Now, of course, our relationship with the Americans isn't just between prime ministers and presidents. It's between states and provinces. I mean, it's huge, right? But still, as we cast a glance towards the South and this election campaign heating up, you know, what could be done? What could be done to make it better? Part of the problem, I think a lot of people have pointed out in recent times, is that we lack a plan. We need sort of a strategy to deal with the United States. And it feels like for a long time, we've just sort of lurched from one thing to another, depending on who's in the White House and so on. And it feels like we haven't really had a concrete plan about how we can be the kind of partner that is both, that we can be proud of it as well. You know, you don't want, we're not, this isn't about fealty, but it is about understanding where the Americans are at and how we can fit into that, right? So some of our best foreign policy minds, period, have gotten together to sort of chart a path for this country ahead of the election. They laid out some of it over the weekend in a really great long-form piece in the Globe and Mail called Canada Needs to Have a Plan for the U.S. No Matter Who Becomes President, and that starts with making us matter more. And that really is the key here. Do we matter less now in Washington? And if so, how do you fix it? Drew Fagan is one of those who co-authored that piece in the Globe and Mail. He's a professor at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto, and he joins me now. Drew, thank you for your time tonight.
My pleasure, Ben.
The timing of this, I mean, I think one of the reasons I was so interested in picking it up and reading, it's not a short article, is just the timing is perfect, because I think a lot of us are looking to what's happening in the U.S. and thinking, okay, well, what impact, you know, would either of the nominees have on Canada right now? But this was much broader than that. This was much broader than just, I mean, it was interesting. You said Donald Trump focuses the mind, right?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So we've been thinking about this, we being the University of Toronto and the Public Policy Forum, about Canada-US relations, and in particular, Canada's role with regard to that bilateral relationship for a while now. And there's a whole project that we're planning for which this piece is really the first step. And it is tied, obviously, to the U.S. presidential election, but it's meant to be, you know, broader and deeper and maybe longer than that, recognizing that we need to think about that relationship, not in an entirely different way, but in a much smarter way, given the challenges the United States is going through.
I think a lot of us outside of the public policy realm or the government realm understand that things have changed. I mean, with the passing of Brian Mulroney recently, obviously there was a lot made of free trade and that relationship in the 80s between Ronald Reagan and Prime Minister Mulroney, as well as with George Bush, rather senior. But it's interesting when we look at it now, because I think we have difficulty putting our finger on exactly what's changed, but it feels like something has changed.
Something really has changed. And part of that is the way the world has changed. If you think about Canada-US in, say, the 1980s, when we were negotiating free trade, you know, the deal done, 1989, when it was brought into effect, was just at the time when the Berlin Wall fell. And there was some sense of euphoria about sort of the victory, really, you know, the triumph of Western values and the fact that economics had triumphed over maybe military considerations, even the end of the Cold War and things like that. So when we negotiated, when Canada negotiated free trade with the United States, that was the issue. Trade, investment, overwhelmingly so. And now what we're seeing is kind of what some people call the return of the jungle globally. You see Russia, you see China, you see a United States, which was dominant in that time, 30, 35 years ago, completely dominant, and still dominant to a certain extent, but with huge challenges of our own. And I mean, where does Canada fit within that harsher world, if you like, sitting on top of the United States in what used to be pretty rarefied geography and still is to a certain extent, but not nearly as rarefied as we once thought. So think, for example, about military relations and what we can do or need to do with the United States in the context of that, more complicated world. Think of the Arctic and the opening of the Arctic and the fact that we never would have thought this way a generation ago. We really have effectively a border with Russia. We don't think of it that way because it's not a land border, it's a water, it's an ocean. But nevertheless, we effectively border Russia. What do we think with regard to the United States and other partners in that context? And then as well, in the economic realm, in the 1980s, we were thinking in one way about deeper integration. What are the factors that will bring us closer together for mutual benefit on the economic side? In the 1980s, it was energy. Is it still energy? Not so much. Maybe it's something like critical minerals or other aspects of technology in which we should be working more closely with the United States. So things have become a lot more complicated, and they become more complicated in the context, obviously, of what the United States is going through and what that means for us.
What's been interesting about it, too, is if I think back over the last, this century, for instance, I think back to Jean Chrétien and going to Afghanistan, not going to Iraq was sort of one of the big issues that we had with the U.S. when it came to our bilateral relationship. And then there was sort of the tension between Stephen Harper and Barack Obama, the decent relationship between Justin Trudeau and Barack Obama. Then Donald Trump comes in. So it feels like it's been unsettled for this whole century, more or less. But you talk about sort of going from indispensable to going to somewhat dispensable as an ally to the U.S. And that was a really interesting point, because I think many things have gotten in the way, but it feels like we've always kind of been trying to figure out what our role with the U.S. is now, and it doesn't feel like it did 30 years ago.
The relationship has always been remarkably asymmetric. We think of Canada sometimes as sort of a small market economy. It's not a small economy by any means. It's the 10th biggest economy in the world. And obviously, geographically, we're immense. We're only small compared to the United States. We have an economy that's less than one-tenth the size of theirs, a population one-ninth the size of theirs. And in the context of what the United States is going through, when you think about populism, when you think about nationalism, when you think about protectionism, and you think about the division within the parties and an election coming forward in which the two parties in some ways, don't just disagree, but actively hate each other. And, some will, say absolutely that the fault lies with one party or the other to a greater extent. And I think Donald Trump is a candidate and a president unlike just about any other in our lifetime or beyond. So you have issues with regard to what's happening with the United States. But in the context of a changing world as well, I think our premise is, despite what's happening with the United States, it's driving us closer in some ways to the United States. If you're going to choose to put it cartoonishly between China, Russia, and the United States, obviously you're going to be closer to the United States. What does that mean for us economically? What does that mean for us militarily? What does that mean for us strategically? And we need to think a lot smarter about that. For example, in military terms, we've always been something of a free rider with the United States. We've worked together in NATO. We've worked together remarkably well in NORAD, but we have not come close to meeting the NATO expectation that we spend 2% of our gross domestic product on the military. We spend much less. In the announcement a few weeks ago, there was a big increase planned. Well, the United States, and this is particularly true of the Republicans and especially Donald Trump, and to a certain extent true of the Democrats, expect us to spend substantially more. So if we're going to do that, where can we get the most bang for our buck? Which takes me back to the Arctic, mm-hmm. which seems to be, you know, the largest premise. But we're feeling our way through all these aspects now in a different world.
Indeed. And as you point out in the article as well, I mean, we've attempted, I mean, each of the prime ministers I mentioned earlier at some point in their terms tried to sort of diversify Canada's economy and find new trading partners. I mean, I remember, you know, legions of people going to China, trying to expand into China. Of course, that's hit a rough time at this point. But again, yeah. Here we wake up in 2024 and our reliance, as you point out, our reliance on the state U.S. economically as our trade partner is still as important as ever. And just in terms of a very kind of a more hostile world, in many ways, we're even more allied to them than we were maybe at the end of the Cold War.
Exactly right. So our trade with the United States in terms of our total trade is going up again.
Right.
You know, at the end of the Cold War, it was as high, the early days of free trade, it was almost 90% of our total trade. Got down to a little under 75%. It's now going back up towards 80%. There is no industrialized country in the world that is as dependent on one market as we are on the United States, which sounds like a remarkable thing. But then you think about the size of the U.S. economy, which is bigger than the entire economy of the European Union or all of Europe. And you think, well, that's not so remarkable considering our geography. And we have tried over many, many efforts and prime ministers to try to balance. But even now, as you say, after, you know, the growth of China, I think the difference is, we trade with the United States almost 15, 20 times as much as we trade with China. Mm-hmm. Part of that challenge is the degree to which we trade in products that are easily purchased by the United States, particularly natural resources. And part of the issue is going back up the value chain. And there are other issues of competitiveness as well.
Drew Fagan is with us, professor at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. Drew, I was interested, you pointed out a really interesting example, and I've been following the war in Ukraine very closely, about uranium and Ukraine that I don't think many Canadians know much about, but how Canada actually did step up and fill a void that the Americans were happy about, that obviously the Eastern Europeans have been happy about, that Canada can, in fact, when we target, like we always have, when we target something and do it well, people notice and it's applauded.
Yeah, it's a really interesting example, and it has to do with uranium. Cameco, one of the major uranium companies in the world, has been for generations, was approached by the Ukrainian government after the invasion. The challenge for Ukraine was that it's highly dependent on nuclear reactors for energy, and much of that energy, uranium, was coming from Russia, their enemy. Mm-hmm. And they needed to diversify, if you like, or, you know, they asked for Canadian supplies. We managed over a period of months to not just restart a mine in Saskatchewan, process the uranium, ship it to Europe, turn it into rods, get it into Ukraine. And now all of the reactors in Ukraine that are still operating, and all of them are not, are operating off Canadian uranium. What's remarkable is, the story's remarkable in and of itself, but now on top of that, there are a number of countries in Eastern Europe, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, a couple of others who want to do the same thing. And I would add that the United States produces almost no uranium. You know, if you go back to the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project, that was for the most part Canadian uranium used then. Canada is the biggest supplier of uranium to the United States, but the next biggest suppliers are Russia, Kazakhstan. So when we think about providing value to the United States, isn't that a four-point play in which you not just send more exports of a strategically important product to the United States, but you replace Russian uranium. It just makes so much sense. And in fact, there are discussions going on with regard to that. So as we think about those products that are fundamental to U.S. interests and fundamental for us to produce, and again, to go up the value chain, I would put that as one at the top of the list. And it's less well known than the things we've been talking about, like critical minerals and others, which are certainly important.
Yeah, and LNG and others. What's been interesting is just how it fits into your broader argument, though, about how it's sort of, in some ways, it feels like maybe it's because the U.S. has become less predictable over time and more politicized, but it's our ability to sort of figure out where they're going and kind of fit into it as an ally. And I know you don't want to be, it's not about fealty, but it is certainly about appreciating the fact that they're the powerful one in this relationship.
And thinking about the mutual self-interest, those circumstances where our self-interest, our separate self-interest become mutual, and there are plenty of them, doing more on the economic side and doing more on the security side. But also, we've thought through much of our history about it being a balance between deepening with the United States and broadening or diversifying. We naturally think in that way. But now, again, it's a more complicated world. I guess a key premise in the piece is that deepening and diversifying are not opposites anymore. And think our best example, in fact, and it wasn't well known, was this example with Ukraine, in which we are effectively helping the war effort, for which the United States obviously is leading, by working closely with Ukraine. Well, that's diversifying, but it's also helping the United States fundamentally. And if we end up sending more uranium to the United States, which seems like a natural step to push away Russia, that would be thought of typically as deepening. But you could also see it as a big impact in a diverse way with regard to Europe and in fact, Russia, right?
Indeed. Well, Drew, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to catching up as you continue working on this ahead of November.
My pleasure, Ben.
We'll talk a little bit about work now. Actually, we'll talk about getting a job or getting a promotion, right? Just how important should a university or college degree be when it comes to landing a job or a promotion? How important is it still? Well, for several years now, there's actually been a push on to get employers to recognize the value of dropping degree requirements from job descriptions. It's called skills-based hiring, and it's meant to tackle several issues all at once. Now, one of them is opening up a wider candidate pool for employers in what has been a tighter labor market of late, right? So it makes sense for the employer to cast a wider net. It's also about equity, recognizing how much requiring a degree isn't just unwarranted for many jobs. It actually actively eliminates a big chunk of people, including those who simply can't afford the expenses of a degree and the student debt that often comes with it. And then there's the pace of technological change. You know, are university and college grads these days emerging from school with the kinds of skills they actually need, or at least the kinds of skills that should present them with an important leg up in any competition for a job? And within an organization, if you know the job, should a degree be, they call it the paper ceiling, right? The paper for the actual degree. I don't know if they do, they must still put degrees on paper. But, you know, do you actually need a degree to move up from, say, a position at a company into the management ranks of a company, right? Do you really need a degree, considering you've been there learning it the whole time? Now, lots of people go back to school and retrain while they're working and so on, but it's not always possible, right? So because there's been so much technological change of late as well, you know, are you really, if you've been working within the organization as this change is happening, are you really less qualified than someone coming out of school these days? I mean, these are all valid questions about what was sort of an orthodoxy for a while, that you needed a degree to get a job or to get certain jobs. Recently, I was reading this report that was done by the Burning Glass Institute in the U.S. alongside the Harvard Business School. They're their project on managing the future of work. And they really looked into whether or not, we know that more companies are open to this, but is it making a difference? already, is it? So we thought we'd ask. So Srinidhi Rao is the chief of staff at the Burning Glass Institute, and he joins me now from Brooklyn. Srinidhi, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
This is a really interesting topic, I think, because we've often, I think, just here and there, I've heard stories, read stories, probably things that you've been involved in, about employers, specifically with the labor market so tight, really trying to get beyond this idea of the university degree being the way you start to sort of, you know, weed out your candidates. When did that begin, really? When did this whole idea of kind of rethinking that? Because when I was coming up through into the job market, it was kind of gospel for quite a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a long history. So throughout the late 20th century, there was a rise, obviously, in Americans earning college degrees with a greater frequency. And then employers, government agencies, and other folks started putting these degree requirements on their job postings more and more, to the point that today, where we have really an excess of job postings on roles that don't often need them. And there's a few roles that we highlight in our report where there are more requests for those candidates than workers who have degrees in those fields. So we've got a bit of a mismatch. And it's, as you highlight, especially in a tight labor market, employers kind of leaving talent untapped.
And there's been, I mean, organizations such as yours have been looking into this for quite a while, trying to figure out, and you refer to it quite rightly as the paper ceiling, right? That degree ceiling.
Yes, exactly. So a lot of workers, we believe, have the skills to do a lot of these jobs, and they're being gated by this degree requirement instead of workers hiring them and looking at the actual skills that they possess.
And you've mentioned that actually, when you think about it just numerically, you're leaving a huge chunk of potential candidates out of your hiring process by having that as one of the initial requirements.
Exactly. So we did some analysis. If you look at some specific roles, web designers, for example, 91% of them, the job postings require a bachelor's degree, but only 71% of web designers have a bachelor's degree. So you have a 20-point mismatch there, and there's going to be roles that go unfilled because of that. So it is definitely a big issue.
Where did you start to see, because I think one of the things that was interesting is you sort of wrote this original article alongside the Harvard Business School a while back, and then you followed up on it, that you've seen now this shift from certain organizations, not all, but certain organizations are trying to sort of expand this. What have they been doing? I mean, how have they been rethinking this of late?
Yeah, so in the past decade or so, there's been obviously a huge focus on equity, right? Employers are starting to think about how can we create hiring processes that are more fair. And one of the steps that they're doing, in addition to a host of, you know, DEI initiatives on one end, is rethinking the degree requirements for their roles. And so we're beginning to see, we're able to analyze the language of job postings, and we see that lots of firms are removing degree requirements from the job postings for certain roles. So over the past decade or so, we've seen a fourfold increase in the removal of degree requirements from roles.
And the, I suppose in that sense, what employers are also saying is that, you know, they do have the ability, if need be, to train in-house, right? I mean, obviously you learn more on your first week on the job than you ever did anywhere else, with notable exceptions, obviously, like medicine and law and so on. But in this case, what kind of companies are sort of jumping into this the fastest?
So all sorts of companies. Mm-hmm. We are seeing companies across industries doing this, from online retailers, healthcare companies, banks, tech companies, aerospace companies. So companies across the kind of industry spectrum are doing this for a set of roles. It's important, like you mentioned a few roles, like medicine, lawyers. Those are not the roles that we're seeing these degree requirements getting dropped from. Mm-hmm. It's important to think about the specific roles. And there are some roles that they don't really require advanced education in the same way being a doctor or a lawyer does, right? And yet these are still some roles that have degree requirements, and now we're starting to see those get dropped.
Right. And the other thing that, of course, is the other side of the token is that it's expensive to get yourself a university degree these days. And often that in of itself leaves you sort of starting off on the wrong foot to some extent. If you enter the job market fighting for one of these jobs and you're coming in with this huge amount of student debt, I mean, trying to find some way to make that more equitable as well. Sort of telling people, if you want to go into this field, you don't necessarily need the degree. Why don't you go out and look to see if there's not a job out there for you or some other form of training that you could take advantage of instead of having to rely specifically on this kind of machine, not that it's an awful one. I think a lot of us have gone through it at some point, but not with the kind of student debt that people are merging with these days.
Yeah. And that's why it's such an equity imperative, right? And college is gated for a lot of people for financial reasons, for a host of reasons. And so that's why we are very invested in this push to skills-based hiring and analyzing where it's going. What we do see in the paper is that while companies are removing degree requirements from their job postings, they're not often following through on that promise. So there's, you know, the talk on the one hand, this what we believe is good intentions to push this greater equity forward, but the implementation and moving this into practice, we're seeing kind of limited results on that end.
Trinity Rao is with us this half hour. He's chief of staff at the Burning Glass Institute. He's in New York tonight. We're talking about the move that's been afoot for quite a while now to try to perhaps limit the requirements for university degrees to get a job. For a while there, of course, when I was entering the job market in the 90s and so on, it became sort of a must for many, many jobs. You absolutely needed a university degree to even be considered for it. And over time, with the tightening labor market, the high cost of university degrees and so on, it's being reconsidered to some extent to see if we couldn't cast a wider net and for equity issues as well as just for practical issues. But Trinity, you mentioned that it is easier said than done, and you've been seeing that already so far.
Right. A lot of times this push towards what we call skills-based hiring or the removal of degree requirements from roles starts at the top. You have CHROs, you have the leaders of companies saying, hey, we want to push this initiative forward. We want to hire more folks without college degrees. But it fails to trickle down towards the ultimate implementers of this practice, which is the hiring manager, right? So you see some disconnect between what's said at the top, the top line saying, hey, let's remove the degree requirements versus the actual execution of actually hiring folks without degrees into those roles. And our research shows that only about a third of firms who remove degree requirements follow through and make tangible changes in their hiring patterns.
Interesting. That few. I mean, I suppose part of it is necessity in terms of who they think they can hire and who they can't, depending on the candidates they get. But there is still that much of a an emphasis still on the degree itself within the hiring process.
Right. Our research, we separated firms into three categories based on what we saw in their actual hiring patterns. One is the skills-based hiring leaders who said they want to remove degree requirements from roles, followed through and hired folks without degrees. Then we have folks who removed the degree requirements but didn't make any noticeable changes in their hiring patterns. We call these the firms that may change in name only. And then we have a third of firms who are backsliding, who change their degree requirements and then actually end up hiring more workers with college degrees. So that's a pretty interesting one.
I mean, when you look at the bigger picture then for what you've been espousing and sort of the research you've been doing as well, I guess the pros and cons here then for companies, because clearly they're still reluctant to break away from this idea that somehow a college, so, you know, an employee with a college degree is more qualified. And I guess, I mean, a lot of it's situational. It depends if you want someone to come in and do, you know, quantum, you want someone to come in and do sort of high level data analytics, perhaps a degree makes sense. And I mean, you know, but overall one gets the impression, especially in a labor market like this one, that you need to be a bit more flexible with this. And I guess it's just hard if you're the one making the hiring decision, right?
Yeah. I think from our perspective, it's probably a couple of factors that are leading to this not being followed through on in practice. First is risk aversion on the hiring managers, right? The university stamp, it carries some weight in terms of what you expect when you hire someone.
Yeah, and they probably have a university degree themselves, right? I mean, that all exactly. often plays into it. It's the prejudice. It's sort of the built-in prejudice of the person doing the hiring. They're like, oh, I have a university degree. We went to the same school kind of stuff.
Yeah. If you hire someone with a degree and it doesn't work out, it's easy to shrug your shoulders. If you take a risk on someone without a degree and it doesn't work out, you could, you know, face the blame on it as a hiring manager. So we believe that risk aversion on the path about the hiring managers is part of the problem. It's also a lack of tools, right? We call this skills-based hiring, but right now it's very hard to assess the skills of a candidate. We have limited tools to do that. You have their resume, you have interviews, which, you know, there's lots of issues of bias creeping into those. So it's hard to tell who has the skills necessary for a job. And so folks often rely on, you know, the degree as a heuristic.
Ultimately, though, I mean, I think the idea of kind of expanding casting a wider net makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, I think we sort of leaned into this orthodoxy of the degree quite heavily for a while, and you know, not because it wasn't necessarily a decent idea, or that people who get university degrees are less qualified than people who don't, but it felt like we leaned a little too far one way, and now it's kind of moving back. But from your perspective, where is the big benefit then, not just for the companies but for the economy and society generally?
So there's a range of benefits, right? Other than, you know, the equity imperatives and stuff that we talked about, our research on skills-based hiring shows that this is beneficial for both workers and employers when they're hiring folks without a degree. Obviously, workers without a degree, when they're hired into roles that, you know, previously asked for a degree, get an increase in pay, on average 25% more than their previous roles. But we also see employers seeing greater retention for folks that they hired without a college degree. So it's likely that these folks, you know, are grateful to have this role that they may not have had access to otherwise, and they reward their employers for taking a chance on them by sticking around. And we know replacing employees is often expensive for employers.
Right. And the diversity of thought too, right? Which is interesting because, again, it's not that universities create automatons, but having diversity of thought within your teams does always lead to better things, generally speaking.
Absolutely.
Where do you go from here then? I mean, you continue to follow this, right? I guess so far it's been that the changes have been, people are obviously acknowledged this and companies are looking to shift a bit, but so far in practice, you just haven't seen a big jump yet.
Yeah. One place we suggest employers to start is skills-based promotion. So you're taking the risk potentially on someone outside your organization without a degree, but all of these organizations have folks who are excelling inside their organizations today that may not have degrees. And so giving these folks more opportunities, promoting them up the ranks, kind of breaking that stigma that you need a college degree to succeed in the workplace, I think is a really good first step that folks who are committed to making this more of a reality can take. Right. But we are interested in learning more of the best practices out there from folks who are leading in this space and making change happen.
Right. Those internal promotions, in other words, we're moving from a position that mightn't have needed a degree to one that normally would. If you drop that there, you might actually see some real results.
Exactly. So it's much less of a risk when you're promoting someone internally and you know they have a track record. And so that alleviates part of the issue.
Yeah. Well, Ashwini Rao, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, Ben. Thank you so much for having me.